How to know for sure whether you can make it back to the airport as a glider. I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller, a CFI who publishes Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. It comes out monthly on the internet. And if you go to overtheairwaves.com, you can find out when and even sign up to get an email notice when it arrives. And Bob has started into a series in his monthly newsletter called Airwork, in which he goes back to some of the basics that we should have learned and mastered in primary training and maybe did, but after a period of years, maybe they've gotten a little rusty. And these are things that are frequently problems that show up in NTSB reports. Bob, thanks for taking some time out for our listeners today.
Well, thanks, Paul. And this airwork business is a timely topic, given a lot of the recent events, and particularly in airline operations.
Well, and let's talk about this particular month's column in the February edition of Over the Airwaves. You called it Engine Failure in Flight. Now, you know, I remember this brings to mind a lot of things when I think about an engine failure, one of which is, you know, the whole paradigm of flying a twin engine aircraft. And a lot of times we read about accidents where that redundancy that we're always told you should have if you're going to fly night or instrument, whatever, didn't really do anybody a lot of good. But in a lot of cases, it seems to come down to people just doing the wrong things in reaction to this kind of emergency happening. And that seems to be where you started.
Well, that's exactly right, and your reference to twin engine operation is right on. Twins are the accident data on twins is much better than singles, only if the pilot is proficient at his craft. In other words, he is proficient on what to do with an engine failure on a twin. Unfortunately, the vast majority of pilots that are flying twin engine aircraft have lost that proficiency. So that on the grand scheme of things, the safety record with a twin versus a single is virtually identical. The thing that we have to do both in any aircraft that we're flying, whether it's a twin, a Cessna 172, or a Boeing 747, we need to be absolutely proficient at our craft. And the only way to be proficient is to practice, practice, practice. The airlines have done this to a fault by requiring flight crew members to go into the box, into the simulator, every 6 months to a year. This is something that they have to do to practice things that do not happen very frequently.
Well, now, when an engine fails, I can understand why someone's first instinct would be, well, there's a perfectly good airport right behind me. And they may even think it through to the point of thinking that, you know, I took off upwind. That means I can travel farther going the other direction than I could in the direction I'm going now. But that almost never works out.
Well, it doesn't. And the physics of what you just said proves it to be the case. You know, there's a natural desire to return the airplane to an airport, particularly if it's your own airplane or it's an airplane you spent several years building. The desire to return, that little voice in our head says go back to the airport, is extremely powerful. But when you do the physics of it and you look at it and practice it, and there is a safe way to practice this at altitude, and you do it pretty much the way it would likely happen for real, the chances of making a safe return to the airport, if you're anything below pattern altitude certainly or higher, I would retract that and say probably 2,000 feet at least, the safe return to the airport is the odds are working against you. Stated in a positive way, the odds are much better in your favor landing straight out, even if there are obstacles out there.
Well, you talk about some things we should all do. Among them, open the POH and study what it has to say about engine failures in flight. And I think a lot of people may overlook that, but that's aircraft specific, and that's been developed by, you know, the engineers and designers who built the airplane.
Well, yes, and it's something that, again, we just do not practice since the last time we took a check ride in that airplane. I mentioned a few weeks ago when we were talking that I had an engine failure in a Cessna Corvallis at 9,500 feet, and myself and another instructor. And in retrospect, I was amazed at the lag time that both he and I displayed in diagnosing the problem. I mean, we were both like standing like deer in the headlight. We looked at each other and said, we don't believe this has just happened. Fortunately, we had a lot of altitude underneath us, and we could take our time to resolve the problem. Had that happened shortly after takeoff, I mean, just the delay in our response time would have been sufficient to preclude even possibly a safe landing to a nearby suitable site.
Well, one of the items on your list, too, is know how to compute the maximum glide distance for your aircraft. And I talked to a lot of pilots of small aircraft, and especially those who rent, don't really have a clue. I mean, you ask them and they kind of get this quizzical look on their face. What's your glide ratio? If you don't know that, you're at a real disadvantage in decision making.
And I think knowing that, if you're like out over Lake Michigan, it's important to know whether or not you have a chance to make either shore. But oftentimes, the best site is not necessarily the distant site. The best site might be directly underneath us. But going back to knowing the gliding distance, it's published, I believe, in almost every modern pilot's operating handbook. They'll have a little chart and a little table. I know in my own airplane, I actually have put a table, I reproduced the table, and it's pinned to my visor along with some other emergency data that I don't keep uppermost in my memory all the time. So if I have an engine failure at 9,000 feet, I know precisely, not by memory, but by simply glancing up at that chart, I'll have a pretty good idea at that altitude how far I can glide. And then I can punch in a distance, you know, to an airport in the GPS and know whether or not I have a shot to make it. But I would like to say, before it slips my mind, again, there's this overwhelming desire to make it back to an airport. When a nice cornfield that's been recently harvested, a golf course, even a four-lane highway, it might do more damage to the airplane, but the odds of walking away from that, both ourselves and our passengers, may be far greater than trying to stretch a glide to an airport and then hit trees along the way and then suffer, you know, the ultimate destiny, you know.
Well, you have a bunch of other items on the list here, and I will refer listeners to Over the Airwaves, the February edition, to find them. But when we come back from the break, Bob, you outlined a very specific, repeatable, safe procedure to demonstrate to yourself in your particular aircraft what would happen if you tried to turn back for the airport, and I want to talk about that in a moment. Bob Miller is my guest. We'll be back shortly. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près de moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. And in the February edition, Bob's Airwork column is on how to determine margins for whether or not you can return to an airport. Bob, I almost hate to go here. This is a great test, and it'll demonstrate a lot of things if you try it in your aircraft. But actually, you know, there are times when you don't even want to think about turning back to the airport. But if you want to find out just what the odds would be, describe the procedure you outlined for determining this at a safe altitude.
The procedure is really quite simple. Climb to a safe altitude, at least 3,000 feet AGL, on a known heading. And then slow the airplane to rotation speed as if you were taking off from the ground. Put out, you know, whatever flap setting you would have for takeoff. And then as soon as you're just below rotation speed, apply full power and then begin a normal takeoff climb. And just as you reach about 3,300 feet, say 300 feet above the ground, simulating that, say 3,300, we're starting at 3,000, pull the power to idle. And this is important. Wait, and as I mentioned earlier in this discussion of ours, wait 4 seconds. And that's the typical normal reaction time before we begin to do anything. 4 seconds is that what I call the disbelief time. And then commence a simple 180-degree standard rate turn, and note that it'll take about a minute to accomplish this turn. And then we have to turn again another 45 degrees to align ourselves with the runway. And just as you complete this turn, then look at the altitude that you have descended to. And if you follow the math that I have in Over the Airwaves, you'll quickly discover that you're going to be several hundred feet below, at least, below the field elevation of the airport that you're trying to get to. In other words, you would bore a hole that would go several hundred feet into the ground. It's a very, very telling exercise, and it's something that we should practice.
Assuming we know these things, there are going to be times when you're running out of time to think about it. This could happen to you a mile off the end of the runway, and you may be in a situation where just taking time to do the calculation costs you yourself and the aircraft.
All you really need to know after doing this exercise several times is what minimal altitude above ground level do we want to be at to consider a return to the airport. Now, in this exercise, I proved that 300 feet above the ground is way insufficient to make that turn. Now, in your particular airplane, the technique that you're using, and we're assuming still wind conditions, not a lot of wind in any direction, you may find you need to be at 700 feet AGL, 1,000 feet AGL. I fly gliders, or I used to fly gliders, and we always had that point at which a tow line break would be catastrophic. And we knew that we would count that off in our head as we climbed up and we noticed the altitude. If we had a tow line break at that altitude, we could make it back to the airport versus landing straight ahead. This was taught, and it's taught to most glider pilots. We need to know this number for power flight. At what altitude must I be in order to have a reasonably safe chance of returning to the airport? And it's different, believe me, for every airplane.
Well, Bob, it's a great article. It got me thinking, and I hope it will our listeners as well. And look forward to talking to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
You can find the current edition of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, with Bob's articles for this month, at www.overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.